Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone. This is why I need Mark. This is really why I need Mark, because he can tell me if my mic got muted. All right. Apologies for the minutes of silence. This is Damn You, Hollywood. I'm Robert Winfrey, the man who still cannot figure out how to prevent my mic from randomly turning off. Great way to start the show, Robert. Good job. Be better off putting your hand into a wood chipper. All right. Tonight on Damn You Hollywood, we will be reviewing Atomic Blonde. And I got to say this again. I have to say this again because I spoke when my mic was muted. Mark will not be joining us this evening. He told me this about 20 minutes before airtime. I knew. excuse me. And hope he feels better in the near future. Really sorry that I don't get to talk with him about this because I was interested in hearing his perspective on this film. And because, well, let's face it, the show, when it's just me, is not nearly as good. The lack of dynamic, the lack of actual conversation, the lack of differing viewpoints, it's all gone. So I hope you'll all just kind of suffer with me through just me talking to all of you, basically, while I go through this film. I have to give this again. Here's your spoiler warning, guys. This is it's kind of a spy thriller action movie, and not spy in the sense of Tom Cruise. Yeah, he's a spy. No. Mission Impossible is not a spy series. Hasn't been since the first film. But because it is loosely categorized as an espionage thriller, there is a plot, there are characters, and you might care about twists and turns along the way, twists at the ending, so on and so forth. So, just here's your spoiler warning, everybody. all right. Sorry, I got really thrown off by that, guys. And my rhythm's off because this is normally where I would throw something to Mark. So, all right, sorry. No more whining. Okay, Atomic Blonde. It's an adaptation of a graphic novel. The graphic novel in question is The Coldest City. You can actually listen to the Source Material podcast. Review that bit of work. That usually goes live Mondays here on the Rattlesnake Broadcasting Network. So feel free to listen to that. It's Mark, Jesse Starcher, and Ronnie Adams talking about, again, the novel in question. This, I have to imagine this largely got made because Charlize Theron became a more visible star over the last couple of years. In terms of, like, bigger releases, I mean, she's always been a terrific, real utterly fantastic actress to many respects. But she didn't get a whole lot of, like, major blockbuster releases, I seem to recall. Then she's one half of starring the lead in Mad Max Fury Road and essentially steals that whole movie. Not that I want to undersell Tom Hardy, who does a terrific job as well, but she's the one that people kind of left talking about. And then she played the villain in the most recent Fast and the Furious movie. So getting even a smaller budgeted film just starring her, see, again, it seems like came about due to circumstances. More than some great outcry for we must have this adapted, because the novel itself is, again, my only frame of reference for the graphic novel is source material in this instance. So, and it doesn't see, this isn't like massively acclaimed or groundbreaking. It's just solid, decent enough. So, as far as personally, because okay, normally this is where we'd talk expectations and what brought us into this. I don't know why Mark changed his. I think the reason Mark wound up adding this to the schedule was he found out it was adapted from a graphic novel. Consequently, it gives source material something to talk about, and then he and I could review it. I was interested in a cursory sense, mostly because I'm a fan of Charlize Theron's. I will make no bones about that. And all of the action sequences that were showed in the trailers, I was really into. I liked the way they were choreographed and shot. I liked the stunt work. And look, I've said something else. I make no bones about being a fan of violence and quasi-realistic violence in the setting of a movie. I'm a fan. I'm willing to go along with that. So there's a good chance I would wind up seeing this movie even if we weren't going to review it here. But Mark decided to add it to the schedule. I had no objections. And again, that's kind of all my expectations were. If I'd done some research before going into this, I might have felt differently than I did, which is not to say there's anything wrong with it in some respects, but A, there's a slight issue of marketing in that they marketed this as a balls-to-the-wall action-packed feature, and elements of it are much more subtle than that. And I also wouldn't have been surprised by elements of style, because this is directed by David Leitch. I believe that's how his last name is pronounced. And he's primarily he's the guy who directed John Wick. So I would not have been surprised by elements of how this came about. In fact, he left the sequel to direct this movie. He left John Wick Chapter 2 in order to direct this one, so. Oh, he's directing Deadpool 2. I kind of hate that there's a Deadpool 2. That's really all I have to say there. All right. Again, done some research into that, I would have expected elements of how this thing was executed, because John Wick, let's be fair here, there's a lot good about John Wick. Keanu Reeves performs the stunts admirably, but the plot is a paper-thin one, even for a revenge film. And most revenge movies have thin plots to begin with. And it is primarily about both world immersion, because he has, let's be fair to John Wick, there's a fairly complete world that is envisioned by the writing. And then it's about the action sequences. This one's not quite as thin in the plot as John Wick was, but it's also, again, the genre setup is very different as well, so. But again, this is clearly a director with a visual style and a knack for doing that more so than narrative substance. All right. And again, had I expected that going in, I would have. My experience would have been a little bit different. Okay. As for the movie itself, that I've rambled to myself for 15 minutes or so. Okay, here comes your old plot synopsis, guys. We open with the death of a spy stationed in Berlin. This is, I believe he's stationed in West Berlin, but is okay. Brief. The important thing here, that as far as setting goes, this is actually kind of important. This is set again in Berlin during the days just before, and then like one day during the collapse of the Berlin Wall. I actually promised Gavin Napier, a mutual friend of Mark and mine, and that I would actually talk about some of the history of this, so very briefly, and why some of this is important for people who just don't know about the history or aren't interested in it. Here's a bit of context. In the wake of World War II, the Soviet Union wanted to expand from the borders of Russia on its western border, because it used to just like end at Russia. And then after World War II, it absorbed some of the Baltic countries, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, Moldova, not Moldova, that's a different country, Estonia, Poland, Hungary. I mean, feel free to Google the Iron Curtain, which is a visual representation of it, not a physical thing. Problem was that Russia and elements of NATO there was no clear thing about what to do with Germany. So they wound up cutting Germany in half. You had East Germany, that was controlled by the communists and the Soviet Union, and West Germany, which was democratic and allied with NATO. The reason Berlin becomes an issue is not only because it's the capital of the country, but Berlin is located relatively far east within the country of Germany. When they decided to split Germany into East and West, they didn't want to assign a new capital to West Germany, so they split Berlin as well. Berlin as a city, as a whole, is located in East Germany, but the western half of Berlin is separate and associated with the other. I mean, there's actually a whole thing earlier in history from the point of the story about the Berlin, was it the Berlin airship? I can't remember specifically. But the Soviets basically cut off Berlin, West Berlin from the outside world. So all of the people allied with them staged these tremendously precisely timed series of airdrops, basically day in and day out of the airport, to keep them supplied while that was going on. But this was also the stage for a lot of espionage historically, because you had major government center in East Berlin and a major government center in West Berlin. So during the Cold War, this was kind of a hotbed. Yay, temperature jokes. And then in like the early 60s, I think it was 61 when they actually split Berlin with a physical wall. It had already been split ideologically, but you could travel back and forth with relative ease. I mean, there were checkpoints on roads, but it's just a city. And then the Soviet Union and East Germany get really, really sick of people leaving, because they would walk across a street, basically be in West Germany and then secure citizenship in the capitalist-controlled part of the world instead of the communist-controlled part of the world. They didn't like it, threw up the wall. And then the machine guns and anti-personnel trenches, and it's a whole thing. But the important thing, again, there's a lot of espionage that takes place in that city at the time. Buys does a half-decent job of kind of explaining elements of that. It's a Spielberg film, I believe. So that's our setting. It's pretty much entirely within this city. I know that's not the full two-hour lecture I kind of hinted to Gavin that I would give, but there's your brief historical background on some of the politics of the time and the state of Germany. So there's a British intelligence officer who was killed by a member of the KGB. There's elements of this narrative that are set up in an interesting way, because we see that. Then we flash forward to Charlize Theron's character of Lorraine Broughton as she is being debriefed, basically, about the events that took place during a 10-day period. So we get some back and forth chronological jumps, and as always, you get a bit of the question of the reliability of the narrator. And I'm a big fan of the unreliable narrator as a story choice because it opens up all kinds of fun possibilities. Lorraine is then dispatched to Germany to... Here's my big gripe. Mark's not here to yell at me about editorializing during my synopsis, so I'm going to get away with just a few of these. The big MacGuffin here for this story is a microfilm list that contains the names of every deep cover intelligence operative. Basically, that either the Western Allies or the Soviets have abroad, or I mean, lists like this don't exist because then you could have people get them. It's stupid, right? These don't exist for a reason. Each country might keep one individually, but there is a lot of that. I mean, of their own, they will keep one. There will be ones that they can confirm are foreign powers. There might be speculations, but they don't get together. So my gripes about elements of that aside, the gentleman who was killed was in possession of this list, and there's a lot of speculation that the wall's about to come down in Berlin. There's, you know, elements of the Soviet Union are starting to crumble. But if, you know, news gets out about all the deep cover operatives that are within these organizations, bad stuff happens. Not just the loss of life, but there's ideological swings that can occur. Information that can be brought out. Temperaments can change. Political climates. It's just bad. Again, hence its title is a MacGuffin. It's just the thing we're getting here. Her primary contact when she is dispatched to Berlin is James McAvoy, a character by the name of David Percival, I seem to recall. Anyway, he's, I believe they describe him in her briefing as having gone a little bit native and a tad feral. That's not inaccurate. He's a bit of a wild man. He's been in the trenches of this, you know, again, the Cold War for just a bit longer than maybe is healthy. There is no British embassy in East Berlin or in West Berlin, I seem to recall. So he's kind of left to his own devices. Or he's stationed primarily in East Berlin, and naturally there's no British embassy in East Berlin in this instance. And he's become a bit too obsessed with the game, and I don't want to go through every individual twist and turn. I'm just going to kind of lay this out as it happens now. Lorraine arrives in Berlin. She is immediately pseudo-abducted by elements of the KGB. Oh, sorry. The other important thing is not just this list, but the identity of a double agent codenamed Satchel, who is, by definition, as a double agent, feeding information to kind of both sides. And no one knows who it is. In fact, the gentleman who's killed in the beginning of the film believes that Satchel's the one who set him up. Very little reason to believe he's being untruthful about that, actually. And so, her primary goal is to obtain the list and secure the evacuation of the individual who secured it for them. He's a Stasi officer who has also memorized the list. Apparently has a photographic memory. He is bartering passage for him and his wife and daughter into the West because he doesn't want to live under the Soviet Union anymore. I don't know. Wants to better his life and wishes to go to the Western part of the world. If you're not familiar with espionage thrillers, there's a lot of twists and turns that occur. There's going to be a lot of those here, so bear with me a bit. Anyway, she's pseudo-abducted. She escapes, meets up with Percival. They have some back and forth. She doesn't necessarily trust him. He's trying to half set her up as a has taken the fall for some of the things he's done. They attempt to locate the list, and again, not trusting each other, that makes this difficult. This doesn't go very well for either of them. The KGB agent who killed the gentleman in the beginning has the list, tries to sell it to the highest bidder. That he is intercepted by Percival, who kills him and reads the list and doesn't actually seem like he wants to hand it over to begin with. Lorraine is mostly at this point interested in getting, after she finds out that this Stasi officer's codename is Spyglass, that he has memorized the list. She wants to make sure he gets out as well. There's some twists and turns as far as, you know, contacts and alliances. There's a French operative who winds up being murdered. And Spyglass is killed when when they're trying to get him across the wall, basically, during the midst of a protest. That whole sequence, I'll talk about that in a second. Anyway, after he dies, but Lorraine survives that particular encounter, I lost my place. Hang on. Yeah, Percival, who at this point has read the list, is trying to set up Lorraine as Satchel, and then so she'll take the fall, and then he'll be able to return. The thing is, he doesn't even really want to return. Like, he sets up to kind of sell the list to the KGB because his whole life has become wrapped up in the game of espionage in Berlin. And while communism is falling, he can maintain a sense of equilibrium by giving the Soviets access to this list. So there's a degree of moral ambiguity here, but there's not a lot of chances for the actors to act, but the chance they do have, they actually take quite full advantage of. Percival is actually the one who kills said French lady, who was in a relationship with Lorraine, because the French chick just doesn't quite have the same heart for it that these other two do. And he's just covering his tracks, so he kills her. Lorraine finds out that he's trying to set her up, winds up killing him, stealing the list. She returns, and then she winds up back in London, where she is being debriefed, which is where we catch up to kind of, and they use some cuts back and forth to her debriefing to go along with the narrative. And she claims not to have the list at this point, in real time. The British intelligence decides that there's nothing to do with all of this information. They're going to bury it, and they place Lorraine on leave. Lorraine actually does have the list. The closing scene is, I like it, but there's almost like they try to dump a bit too much in too rapid succession here. We see Lorraine in Paris, where she reveals herself to have actually been Satchel, the one passing information to the Russians. The Russians try to kill her because they believe she's been compromised or any number of reasons. She turns the tables, kills all of them. Turns out she wasn't actually giving them the list. She then informs the head KGB agent that she's shot in the neck as he's bleeding out. But she never actually provided the Russians with legitimate intelligence. It was all false intel, and everything she got in return she was able to use to help further bring them down. And I think the best line to come out of that was, that sums it up as, I was never working for you, I was working for myself. She shoots him in the head. And then we close with her getting on a plane with the CIA representative, played by John Goodman, actually. Goodman is in possession of the list, and it comes out that wasn't just a double agent, she was actually triple, and was originally a CIA plant within the MI6 organization that wound up, again, half-doubling against them to feed misinformation into the Soviets, and now she's ready to just kind of go home and get back on with regular life away from the insanity of espionage. Now, this is really where I wanted to talk to Mark about things, because for me, this strays dangerously close to the FBI knew that the CIA was setting up the NSA type scenario that we joke about. This gets real close to that, and I don't think it goes too far. Oh, that's just me. Again, it gets pretty close, but I don't think it winds up crossing that line. As for positives about the movie, a lot of people are praising the soundtrack, which is... How do I say this? I think James Gunn did a great thing with the first Guardians of the Galaxy soundtrack. And part of me really doesn't like that everyone seems to be trying to replicate it. Again, you have Guardians 2 where they do it. You have Baby Driver, which does kind of the same thing in terms of how music is used. And you get it here. The musical choices are fine. They are wonderfully representative of the era. Again, November of 1989 specifically, and a lot of it dealing with the culture of Germany, because we're in Berlin at the time. Not a lot of it is to my personal taste, so I'm a bit on the fence there, but its general usage and choice is excellent. The acting done by Charlize Theron and James McAvoy does need a bit of positive attention, because we're dealing with another scenario where there's not a lot of, I don't want to say there's not a lot of dialogue, but there's not a lot of real, like, dramatic moments in terms of, you know, interpersonal discussions. A lot of it's more on the subtle side, and it has to come through in different ways and at different times. There's actually kind of a monologue that James McAvoy gives to Charlize Theron right before she kills him. That's a really a great insight into his character. And is delivered quite well. He does a great job of kind of writing that slightly manic line while also being believable enough when elements of it are revealed to be an act and elements of it a much deeper truth about who he is. He does a great job. This movie is fundamentally sold on the basic premise of you get to watch Charlize Theron be a badass. And in that it excels. She does some really good acting bits, especially in scenes like without dialogue. Our introduction to her character is her physically beat to hell in the wake of the scene I want to talk about in slightly more depth, where Spyglass is killed and she barely escapes. And we see her in the physical aftermath of that, kind of coming out of an ice bath, which is what you do when you're seriously... There's a reason athletes take ice baths, guys. They help. They suck, but they help. And she's, you know, got a badly swollen right eye that... And just covered in bruises and contusions and... The way she acts that whole scene out, I almost really want to... Anytime you get a narrative that is driven by twists and turns like this, for what narrative there is, again, this is narratively loose. Even the ones that execute the same kind of strategy well. There's a movie called Basic starring Samuel Jackson and John Travolta that I happen to deeply enjoy. Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, which is still, I believe, the best spy movie. And I'll stand by that. But any of these that are, again, narrative-driven like that, it's when you finally understand everything at the end, it's almost worth it to go back and experience them a second time with what is essentially perfect knowledge. Because it alters the experience in some respects. And a lot of what Charlize does from an acting standpoint is, and forgive me for getting a little bit actorception here, but she's playing a spy who by definition just acts most of the time. And I tend to believe there's actually a sense of the life, a little bit of shell shock. And she really just wants her life back. And that she's done this for, you know, so long, and she's, I mean, there's just so many layers to the deception that you have to go through, especially in her case. I mean, this is a real thing. This is bad enough for, like, undercover cops can be can wind up dealing with serious issues relative to what they see and do while on the job. Now imagine being a plant in her case, she starts out as a CIA operative who is planted in MI6, who winds up having to convince the Russians that she's turning on the English. And again, level, so many layers. And any movie that you let an actor actually like act when they're dealing with that kind of conflict, there's some really good movies that deal with that. I mean, The Departed actually deals on a very successful level with the stress and issues that go along with being just, again, under just one layer removed. In the case of Matt Damon being a dirty cop and DiCaprio being an undercover cop. And while this is not a character piece, you are not given the same types of insight. I think Charlize does a very, very commendable job of showing it in those quiet moments, of which there are very few. And then, you know, acting the part of a spy. And she and McAvoy both do very, very well in that sense. The other issue here, and this is one of the things I've wished that, like, I'd known about going in. The way they set this up with the marketing drives the action as a lot heavier than it actually is in the story. There's some very good action sequences, and there's quite a few of them. But it's not, I wouldn't call it a straight action movie. There's a lot of, again, espionage that goes on, a lot of trying to figure out who's on whose side, so on and so forth, which is what you get in these types of films. I'm not complaining about it, but again, marketing. And Mark and I talked about this with for the Planet of the Apes. You know, it was marketed as being much more action oriented when it wound up being a deeper character piece, which is not to say good, bad, or indifferent. It's how the marketing went versus how the film goes. There's a little bit of that here. Not as much, but a little bit. The action set pieces are quite good. There's a few of them in particular. The one where she is ambushed by the police as she is looking for information. This is one of the ones that got some play in the trailers. She like beats a man into half consciousness with a hose, which is really good. That one's well set up and executed. I was less in love with there's one where she is chased in East Berlin. Part of it takes place in the theater, which, again, it's acceptable, but it's not great. The final one, not the actual final one, because there's the one in the hotel room that is kind of the capstone, the coda, if you will. And in and of itself, that one's quite fine as well. It's just a lot faster relative to some of these other ones that have longer setups and payoffs. And that one's all gunplay as well. These other ones are primarily hand-to-hand combat. The really interesting one for me was, again, the one where she and I forget the actor, but the guy who's playing Spyglass. I should know the actor because I actually like him. I've seen him in other stuff. Yeah, it's Eddie Marson. I forget how his name is pronounced, but no, I like him. I've seen him in other stuff, and I tend to enjoy his work. Anyway. As they're trying to escape, actually, after Percival shoots him, this is the big payoff for the movie in a lot of respects. This is the one that takes place in a hotel, has hallway fights up and down stairs, through a couple of rooms. There's gunplay, there's knife play. And this, I don't know this to be 100% accurate, but I believe, and this is memory in a lot of respects here, from the time they enter this hotel up until during the car chase as they're getting away, one of the pursuing vehicles is hit by a truck and does a couple of flips. But I think from the point that they enter until that car gets hit by a truck, it is presented as a single shot. I know long stretches of it are, and I think the whole thing is, I'm a sucker for those, all right? That just speaks to my personal taste. It's really excellent. Again, there's and it's the one that's done without music. All the other action scenes in this movie have some culturally relevant, you know, again, 1980s or so pop song. Well, pop might be the wrong word, but, you know, you got some Depeche Mode. There's David Bowie, Queen. He's Under Pressure, I think, at the end. Of course, the very famous German song, 99 Red Balloons. And the German cover of... I can't remember the song. I know how it goes, but I can't remember its name. So forgive... Let's see if I can find it. It's probably going to bother me until I... Yeah, I can't find it. All right, whatever. It's a relatively famous song, especially for the time. I just can't remember what its name is for the life of me. But there's a lot of that. There's a lot of actually, like, chronologically accurate German industrial pop music, which was big for, which was actually pretty big. I mean, the whole East German youth subculture and movement of the 70s into the 80s is a fascinating thing in and of itself. Don't want to go too far into that here. But this one through the hotel is done without musical accompaniment, as far as I can tell, which is, I know why music is in movies. I get it. It helps. I'm generally for it. That makes its absence a very powerful tool when utilized correctly. As another example, I mean, first of all, you have, like, No Country for Old Men, which I don't believe has a musical score at all. Certainly not one worth talking about. You also get stuff like the first Batman and Bane fight from The Dark Knight Rises, which is done without music. And it just provides a different feel that, when used appropriately, can enhance things. And in this instance, it's that, you know, the other action scenes, while important and impactful and whatnot, this is the one they want you to feel as a viewer, rather than one that, you know, has a pop song playing over it that gives you a level of disconnect with. This is the one they really want you to pay attention to and feel. And there's some really, again, there's some great gunplay. There's some great knife play. The fight that she has with the final guy, who then gets up after being stabbed in the neck with a corkscrew. There's a lot good to it. I really do love a lot of the choreography here for most of these action pieces. I like that there's time taken with some of them. I really like that there's physical effects shown. I don't mean that. Okay, how do I say this? I don't mean that in the sense that, you know, the special effects, although those are fine, and the makeup for displaying trauma to the human body in this movie is really good. It's a really good thing. But they show the physical impact of things. There's a guy that, in this hallway scene, that she shoots in the, like, stomach to upper chest. Stomach to lower chest, maybe. Side. And he doesn't just lay down and die. He gets up and he keeps fighting. There's a guy who gets, stabbed near the neck, kind of like around the collarbone, near the junction. And he doesn't just go down and die. He gets up and he kind of keeps fighting until he bleeds out and becomes, you know, unable to do so. And I like that. I really do, because, I mean, you shoot someone in the head, they're going to go down and probably stay down. Shoot someone straight through the heart, you get kind of the same thing. The body, just, there's nothing there anymore. A lot of other things, getting shot's no fun. But if you're in a life or death situation and you are not incapacitated by a shot, you're going to get up and you're going to keep going. And I like that. I like the time that gets taken in some of the, especially this scene. After she and, again, the guy that she winds up hitting with her car later, he's a grunt, but he's distinguished by having, like, bleach blonde hair, so you know he's slightly more serious. I don't know why that particular trope came about. Like, if you have a grunt, but you want to make sure he stands out from the other grunts, and you know that you're going to see him again, for some reason, blonde the hair. Their whole, like, final confrontation before she escapes, those two have beat the crap out of each other, and they're still trying to fight, but there's clearly the physical toll that's been taken. They both struggle to stand. There's a lot of pan. It's very slow in places because they've exhausted themselves in Mortal Kombat. And I like it. Feels very real. I like that. So again, the action being the primary driver of this movie, the scenes such as they are, I very much enjoyed. Then there are issues of writing here. This is a little hard to follow, and I say that as a guy who actually enjoys espionage movies that make you pay attention. Right, I really, again, the Mission Impossible film franchise did a serious blow to the whole genre, and James Bond to a lesser, to a certain extent, depending on where we want to start talking about Bond. Because there are some entries into the Bond franchise that actually do deal with espionage-related things. Others of them are just, again, they're action movies. And Mission Impossible, the first Mission Impossible movie actually is kind of a throwback to the actual spy genre of films. Because the narrative is structured in some respects like a espionage thriller here, it just becomes a little hard to follow because pretty clearly the narrative is less important to this overall film than creating characters that in a relatively brief amount of time that you are familiar enough with to care about as things progress, that you can, you know, pay attention to. And then providing a framework for the action so we don't just have a pure spectacle on our hands. And as a result, again, elements of the narrative and some of the writing suffers. It's a tad disjointed because they're rushing things that in a movie that gets to be just a spy movie take time to develop and mature and you can leave hints about rather than having to be broad with your strokes. So there's a little, and there's a bit of that that's a problem. But I don't think, for me, it wasn't terrible. It was just an issue of, again, it's not the best, again, not the best written thing I've ever seen, but not the worst either. It's more, it more suffers a bit from trying to set an action film within a slightly different genre than it always fits into. And then adapting material that is designed to be an espionage thriller. Setting up a revenge story to be just a whole sequence of Keanu Reeves violently murdering people is fine because the revenge genre can be slimmed down to its bare bones like that without losing some of what makes it a revenge movie in its essence. It's slightly more complicated here because you're taking a genre that is more fundamentally built on subtlety and trying to make it more accessible to audiences who just want to see Charlize Theron kick ass. So it never quite achieves perfect harmony in balancing those two elements, but it leans towards the action, which I think is the right call, all things considered. Let's see. Talked about the actors. Music, it was fine. I think that's all I have here. This is one of those that I really wanted Mark here just because, I know he'd have a very concerted opinion on elements of this movie, and B, I imagine they'd run contrary to my own in some respects. But, again, unfortunately, you guys get a monologue instead of a dialogue, so my bad. Well, not really my bad, but my condolences, I suppose. All right. I think that's everything I've got for that. I suppose I can do it. I don't necessarily like grading movies. It's not really my thing. But if I were to grade this, 80, 85. So in the B range, I suppose it's probably about where I'd land. if you only saw the trailers for this and went in expecting balls to the wall action, you're going to be a little bit by some of the setup and some of the follow through, because it's tries to be an espionage story as well. But there's worse ways to spend the, 100 minutes or so this thing runs. There's a lot of it that I really enjoyed. Classic, no, but I can't complain about too much. I largely got what I was expecting, so there's my recommendation for you if you feel so inclined to see the movie. All right. What does that leads us to? Where is my button? Here it is. I will do my best Mark Radulich impression, and let's talk about the money, guys.
Here comes the money.
Here we go. Money talk.
Here comes the money.
Dollar, dollar.
All right. For this particular weekend, Dunkirk held on to the top spot. The Christopher Nolan World War II film. Dunkirk has earned $102 million worldwide. Hang on, I need confirmation of this. 1 second. My other website here. Yeah, that is okay. Yeah, Dunkirk has done $102 million and change worldwide, which is fine. Held on to the top spot, brought in another $28 million this week, or this last weekend. Had a $100 million budget. It'll be profitable by the time things wrap up. Opening at number two, opening soft, actually, The Emoji Movie. Because we don't have enough stupid things in the world, apparently. The Emoji Movie brought in $25 million. It's The Emoji Movie, guys. It only had a $50 million budget, so that'll probably be profitable by the end of things. There's a comedy called Girls' Night that was held on at number three. It's made $65 million. Atomic Blonde, in this case, opens at number four, $18.6 million. That's less of an issue for this movie. It only had a $30 million budget. That was just opening. It's made $26 million to date. And again, with the $30 million budget, it'll be profitable by the end of things, most likely. Let's see. Next up, we had Spider-Man Homecoming at 13.5. That's made 280 by now million worldwide. That's a solid hit. That's a solid hit for Sony. I mean, mostly Marvel, because they're the ones who didn't cock it up, but Sony is getting a lot of the money there. War for the Planet of the Apes fell down to number six. It had $10 million. It has $118 million taken total. That one might be a harder sell. I can't remember the budget. Let me find it very quickly. War for the Planet of the Apes. There you are. Yeah, I think at a $226 million budget, that's actually going to be a bit of a tough one. That's a real shame. Because it's a great movie. Despicable Me 3, still in the top 10, fell to number 7. Brought in $7.7 million over the weekend. Yeah, look, that thing's made stupid amounts of money. It's worldwide total to date is $823 million. All hail the power of Gru and the Minions, I suppose. One of our other bombs for the year, Valerian and the City of 1,000 Planets, at number 8, has brought in a worldwide total of 30 and change, might be up to 50 by, not 50, but yeah, on a significant budget. Yeah, that thing flops. Baby Driver at number 9 has a total of $92 million overall. So let me double check that. Where were you? July, there you are. Yeah. I'm looking at inaccurate information. Baby Driver's worldwide to date is $138 million on a $34 million budget. That thing is fine. And rounding out the top 10, Wonder Woman hung around for another $3.5 million. Worldwide total is $360 and change, I think. All right. Worldwide totals for the year. The top two are unchanged. It's still Beauty and the Beast, followed by Fate of the Furious. Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 at 800. Those two are both like 1.2 and change billion. Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 is at 860 million. At number 4, moving up to number 4, I think, Despicable Me 3 at 823 million. There's a good, I think, I can't imagine getting another 40 million before it wraps up, but another big hit. Wonder Woman at number 5 with 788 million. Despite it being a relatively terrible movie, Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Men Tell No Tales, $775 million. Spider-Man Homecoming, $636 million. Logan still hanging around the top 10 at $616 million. Transformers The Last Knight cracked the top 10 despite being an... the movie is terrible. The movie is just terrible. It's at $568 million worldwide. It is still not profitable. I mean, it had a budget of $260 million, give or take, not counting marketing. Yeah, again, Mark and I talked about this. If this thing doesn't get close to a billion, by which we mean, you know, $800 to $900 million, it's going to be a loss. And they're opening the spin. I have to yell about this because if Mark were here, he would. They announced the Bumblebee spinoff and its release date. First of all, they cast John Cena as the lead, which I could take or leave. But it's going to open opposite the Aquaman movie. And I don't know how to feel about this. See, Mark thinks it's a terrible idea. For me, it comes down to this. Now, there's significant audience overlap, and I get that. Actually, some of that depends. I think... I can't remember if... crap, the guy directing Aquaman... I can't remember his name. I like him. He did Saw. And Saw 2. And The Conjuring 1 and 2. Damn it, I can't remember his name. I'm going to look it up because now, because I like his work and now it's going to bug me. Let's see. James Wan. Jeez. Can't believe I forgot that. Anyway, I had heard that James Wan might be trying to sell this as more of an R-rated movie. I doubt they'll go that way, but if they do, then all of the small children who are going to go see Bumblebee, you're not in competition with the audience. Here's my thing. If you're going to counter-program a major comic book film, you try to go after DC. Because, look, I enjoyed Man of Steel, wasn't without its faults. Justice League, Batman v Superman was a hot mess. We just now, most recently this year, with Wonder Woman, got a DC film that didn't suck out loud. Well, suck out loud's a bit strong, but that wasn't either wildly divisive or just bad. I mean, I don't think anybody thought Suicide Squad was good, but a lot of people enjoyed it. And tanking, so counter-programming DC as the weaker of the two major comic book film worlds, and then counter-programming a lesser-known hero in the form of Aquaman. Now, I know we're not dealing with the same Aquaman that, like, populated, you know, back when people didn't understand the character. I know we're not dealing with that same one, and... if they use Aquaman correctly in the Justice League movie, people might be more interested in him. Bear in mind when I say use him correctly, that is sparingly, because like the Justice League movie is just, so not looking forward to. But again, if you're going to counter program one of them, lesser known character from the lesser film franchise, I can see it. I don't agree with it, but I can see the logic. Also, because if Bumblebee flops and the Transformers franchise undergoes severe revision or just goes away for a few years, I can forever say that stopping an overblown franchise that was never all that good was indeed a job for Aquaman. All right. I think that's all for the money this time around. Now, unfortunately, I'm going to have to be doing these reviews a little bit in the dark. I'm kind of scrolling and finding ones that I want to yell about. So, again, this is one of those bits that kind of suffers because when I have to do it on my own because it's not as funny. But talked about the movie, talked about the money. Oh, boy. We all know what time it is, don't we?
No, God! No, God, please, no! 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 No!
Okay, for the record, Atomic Blonde has a Rotten Tomatoes rating of 75? 75%. Audience rating 70, 68, and it's fluctuated a little bit. All right, so here we go. Rick Bentley of Tribune News Service. The real problem is the story. It has enough bits and pieces of action and drama to work as a graphic novel. Actually, if you listen to the source material, guys, it really doesn't. But it's not enough to make this movie a roller coaster ride. Okay, can I just... At what point does every movie have to be a roller coaster ride? I mean, if this guy... I'm going to give you the basic credit of assuming that he's prepared to go along with, a purely dramatic movie can be a roller coaster ride as well. I'm not sure he means that. I think there's every possibility this guy means there should be less talking and more fighting. In which case, shut up. You are fundamentally wrong. Two, I don't know if I've told all of you this bit before, but the reason roller coasters work is sudden changes in momentum, right? Up and then down, left, right, loops, swirls. It's the sudden changes in momentum that provide us with the sensational experience. I mean, there's every chance driving on the freeway that you will get going about as fast as the average roller coaster. Not nearly as exciting, right? Momentum shifts. Faster and slower in parts. That's the essence of what makes it up. If you have a movie that is just action, it stops meaning anything. If you have a movie that is pure drama, in a lot of respects, you have to be just as careful because otherwise it becomes the same thing. It's the variant that gives these things meaning. It's letting McAvoy and Theron and some of the other actors actually do a bit of acting from time to time that lets you care about the action, that lets it mean something. Let's see. Oh, here. All right. I really don't like... I don't know who to be mad at for this. Nick Dent from the Daily Telegraph in Australia. Here's a tip. Skip the movie, buy the soundtrack. Okay, let's start with this. Most of these songs already exist out in the world. No one... You don't actually have to buy them. Second, this is not helpful. This is one of my big gripes about these blur... Because you have to have a hook, right? I get that. You need a hook to get people to click on your link and then read the whole thing. I understand how that works. I understand the basic economic principles. It's why I yell at people over the blurbs that are put up. I don't know if it's them. I don't know if it's the editor. I don't know. But they do such a bad job of it. In this instance, you have actively disincentivized anyone from clicking it, whether they agree with you or not. This is just poor execution. Let's see. Al Alexander of the Patriot Ledger. The only thing that keeps you watching besides the terrific music. All these old people, man. I mean, I get that I'm 31, right? I get that. And to a certain segment, maybe even of our audience, I qualify as old. But all these people was like, oh, man, you remember when, Depeche Mode was putting out music, and you know, all that late 80s into the early 90s, right before Kurt Cobain came along. Boy, that was primo. That was quality music. Ugh. I mean, there was some good. There was some bad. And bear in mind, for those of you who don't know, I like can't stand the sound of the Beatles, so your mileage will vary. Is Theron, who establishes herself as the world's foremost action heroine. I can't agree with that. Look, I like Charlize Theron a lot. The preeminent action figure on the female side of things at the moment is Wonder Woman, and there's like $700 million in the bank to help solidify that. I mean, I think Theron's an infinitely better actress than Gal Gadot, but there's reality that needs to be addressed here. Let's see, what else do we have? Robert Levin from AM New York, large market. From endless and endlessly obvious music cues to the painstakingly rendered neon settings and punk rock accoutrement decorating the communist underground, this is a movie about nothing beyond... it's a movie about nothing beyond that setting. I'm not entirely sure how you arrived. I mean, the setting is important. The setting has to be vibrant. But what's more important than the setting is the people and their actions therein. It's more about, again, what side of the fence either one of them falls on. Who can you trust, if you can trust anyone? I mean, the set design and the attention to detail that went into fundamentally recreating that time period in that location are exceptional and definitely need to be discussed, but I just disagree that the movie's about nothing beyond the setting of the fall of the Berlin Wall. It's just not. I mean, there's problems with the movie, but that's not one of them, really. That's not from my perspective. I am not going to give you the time of day. Matt Goldberg of Collider. The way Leach captures all of the fighting, the way Theron sells the hell out of the fisticuffs, and the utter brutality of it is all outstanding. Astounding? Sorry, this guy, like, it makes you wish that the rest of the movie were even half as exhilarating. I can kind of agree with that. Again, the action is far and away the best part of this film. It's designed that way. Here's someone earning their pace. Here's someone earning their paycheck, right? Armand White of the National Review. Atomic Blonde is junk. I mean, again, are we just... I mean, hey, I have to click this. I really do. Just one second. Couches this argument as... He seriously tries to couch this argument as this being feminist propaganda. Okay, this guy's an idiot. I am not giving that the time of day. Oh, it's a feminine lead. It clearly must be feminine propaganda. What the hell, man? Here's one that, and this is one of those, again, that I have to disagree with on a minor level. Rob Vo, I assume that's how his last name is pronounced, at least, of Cinema Stash. If you can live on flashiness alone, it knows how to get the job done. Just don't expect much steak beneath the sizzle. I can't completely get behind the idea that you didn't see the characters being impacted by the world around them. I mean, there's a wonderful visual cue. The picture they show of James McAvoy in the briefing about him being relevant, and then the next time you see him, he looks, again, just visually. There's a visual angle to tell you all you need to know about his descent into madness and chaos. And somehow this individual has completely missed that what happens to the people matters. It could have mattered more, and again, there's issues there, but I just disagree with the extremes he's going to as far as that goes. Let's see. Now, where's one of those guys Mark always likes to review? Oh, here we go. Because, again, we must deal with people who think they're clever. This is guy. Clay Kane of BET.com. Atomically underwhelming. I mean, really? You try to go with that for your hook, right? That you proud of that? Really? You're proud of that line? Let's see. What else do we have? All right. Here's one. And no, I can't get too mad at someone who writes for Movie Mom, because they're going to give this type of movie a slightly negative reaction just writing to your audience, which I think is stupid, but I can understand it at least. Okay, here we go. Moira MacDonald of the Seattle Times. While it's still an enjoyable novelty to spend time during an action movie wondering where I could buy the hero's boots, it's no substitute for a good story. How much can I disagree with this? Again, the story's on the weaker side. I acknowledge that. I suppose I could argue that really there's enough visual style and well put together. I mean, there's a lot of people reviewing movies who don't seem to understand physical acting or nonverbal communication or how to tell a story with minimal dialogue, and it's really frustrating. There's actually a pretty decent story here. It's just not told in the conventional structure. And again, I do wish it had had a stronger narrative, so to speak, but... Okay. No, I agree with that one. Oh, here we go. Here we go. I found him. Joe Morgenstern. Old get off my lawn Joe himself. Of the Wall Street Journal. Top critic. Man paid to review movies. As strong and formidable and commandingly tall as Ms. Theron is, she can't rise above the gloom. Okay, commandingly tall is actually slightly an exaggeration here. I mean, some of this is movie magic, right? You do know Tom Cruise is like 5'6". And there's a reason she can't rise above the gloom and half succumbs to it as a character, because that's the essence of the story. How... Minimal story. I get it. I get that you all wish the writing would have been stronger. And to some, again, I can agree with that. That's a valid criticism. I don't like that our lead character wound up going along with elements of the gloom. No, it's almost like she's a psychologically harangued triple spy who's almost coming apart at the seams, trying to keep everything together, and is now terrified of being outed. How dare that particular character trait express itself over the course of years? Shut up, Joe Morgan. Fire this man. Seriously. Joe Morgenstern. We give that guy entirely too much airtime here. Okay, here we go. Here's one I can sink my teeth into. Michael O'Sullivan of the Washington Post, top critic. Ultimately, Atomic Blonde is, like its heroine, something of a machine. If you want to make a comment about overly produced films, films that, you know, just are churned out on a mimeograph, boy, did I just date myself. Like, no one knows what a mimeograph is. It's a hand-operated duplicating device. It's what you had before you had copy machines and printers. There's a discussion that can be had about movies that are done by the studios and overly produced. And you can, I thought huge sections of Suicide Squad were movie-making by focus group. In this instance, I don't think that's accurate. I think it's just the style of film this director likes to create. That doesn't make it a machine. And here's my big gripe. If you go through this entire film without seeing the ups and downs and elements of the turmoil that the lead character goes through, you've just missed the point. Now, again, has that same story been done better in many respects? Yes. We don't get the same type of obvious conflict and stressors that you get from DiCaprio in The Departed. I get it. And to be fair, that's a very high bar in many cases in terms of quality of writing and acting and the whole nine yards. But I seriously mean, like, watch the beginning of this movie and then contrast that with the very end when she's stripping away the final trappings of her persona and tell me there's not actual change and impact that is had. Much of how she is in the middle is her forcing down, you know, the emotions that can get you killed when you exist in this world. Okay, maybe you just need it spelled out for you. I mean, oh, really? Sorry, okay, next one. So again, Michael O'Sullivan, moron. Just not paying attention. Melissa Anderson of The Village Voice, top critic. Simultaneously Byzantine and dumb. Okay, let's start with this. The fact that you felt the need to qualify that with simultaneously is Byzantine does not mean, it does not preclude dumbness by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, who chose that? Okay, whatever editor chose that as the hook, as the lead in. I mean, I know what you're doing. You are trying to get people to click so that they can find context for the word Byzantine. So they act. That's stupid. You are like the type of person. You're like, what's the family? I'm not going to reference Family Guy. I'm just not going to do it. But I mean, the subtitle of her review is actually At Least the Fights Are Good, which is a much better hook. I mean, this is a poor editing and choice job here. And I seriously argue that this is not a dumb movie. It's not phenomenally deep, but given that so many people missed the mark about figuring out how things relate to characters, I mean, apparently it's not that dumb because there's people still missing it. I want to find one to wrap up on here. No. Much as I'd love to rip into the New York Times for that one, I'm looking for one I can really go out on. No, I don't necessarily disagree with that. Here we go. I got it. I got the last one. Jake Coyle of the Associated Press, top critic. Atomic Blonde is largely a vacant, hyper-stylistic romp that trades on the thick Cold War atmosphere of far better films, not to mention the Americans? Oh, sorry, the television series on FX. Okay, needed to remember the context. It's all dagger, no cloak, but it has two things going for it. See, again, just because something is hard to pick up on doesn't mean it's not there. And yes, it's a very stylized movie. I don't necessarily see that as... At what point did that become a legitimate complaint? I don't know, maybe he's not using it as one, and I'm reading a bit too much into this, but... I mean, everyone has a style. I mean, by definition, calling something hyper-stylized is not the most... It doesn't actually help in discerning things, because... Every director has a style that they are kind of hyper into by definition of it being theirs. So calling it hyper stylized isn't terribly helpful. I mean, I get what they're trying to say here in the sense that this is stylized. I do get it. But really, expand your vocabulary a bit. Let's try not to just lean on half other definitions of words. Treads on. I mean, the Cold War atmosphere, I mean, sure, better films have been set during that era, but a lot of worse ones have as well. I mean, that saying that it treads on, you know, it trades on the cachet of better films because they happen to be set in the same era is fundamentally untrue. I mean, are all World War II movies treading on the, you know, the cache of Saving Private Ryan? I mean, at what point do we just accept that certain settings and certain good movies in settings have fundamentally shifted elements of how we make and view and consume media? I mean, it's all dagger and no cloak isn't even necessarily accurate. There's some pretty interesting stuff going on with different characters gathering information. Again, I wish more had been made of it because I actually enjoy that stuff as well. But there is a significant amount of espionage that just takes place during the down periods between action where they are getting information from each other, where there are recordings going back and forth. There's more dagger than cloak, certainly, but to say it's no cloak is just like, you're just completely dismissing significant portions of the movie that are there for a reason. Oh, I want to yell at this guy. I said that was the last one. I really kind of want to yell at this guy. All right. You know what? I think I will. Richard Brody, writing for The New Yorker, top critic. Gentleman paid to write these things. Theron keeps her cool throughout the pummeling gyrations. You make that... Why do you needlessly write that way? I mean, really? Gyration is not even the right word. Like, you probably lifted pummeling gyrations from a review of a porn movie that you bought or something. I mean, come on. There's... just not the right word. But the film strains to achieve a breathless panache and a lurid swagger for which David Leitch's direction is too heavy-footed and literal. Okay. David Leitch has a specific style. So does everyone else. He's not going to give you the subtleties of, again, espionage-esque sequences that you can get from a Scorsese, from a Spielberg at times, from a... Oh, I forget who directed Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. My apologies, but... Yeah, he's not the subtlest of directors, but you guys act like action sequences don't help tell a story. How do you not get storytelling in a visual medium in a purely visual sense? Do you not understand these things? Moreover, here's the thing, and literal. How do you get the and literal comment here? I mean, bear in mind, I understand there are overly symbolic works, there are allegories. I understand how those things work. I understand how they work in film. But to complain that someone's... Like, film is, in many respects, especially for mass consumption, going to be a literal media. Someone's going to shoot a gun, and it's going to hit someone or miss. And that's not going to be some deep metaphor about societal injustice. It's going to be people shooting at each other to build action and tension or to kill a character. You're the type of person who, like, reads a short story where, I wish I could remember this story, but I remember what happens. It's like an engine on an engine block that falls and crushes a cow's skull. You're the type of guy who would spend 40 minutes debating whether or not the setting of this story takes place in a post-apocalyptic world. Not everything is metaphor. Not everything needs to have extra depth. If I could quote the very famous quote, sometimes a cigar is just a cigar. And there's more than enough place for that in the pantheon of films. Ugh. Ugh. That just depressed me. Like that jackass is running around reviewing movies. All right. On that note, I think that's going to be it for me. Again, apologies. Mark couldn't be here this evening. Hope he's feeling better in the very near future. Hope it's not serious. So get better, Mark. I know we're all pulling for you. Next week, make sure I have this correct. Next week, Mark and I will review The Dark Tower. Yes. I am... I'm excited. I am seriously excited for this one. I am a huge fan of the Dark Tower series. I'm a big Stephen King fan in general. And that's where this comes from. I am torn because I'm such a big fan of it that I warned Mark, like, I might be the guy in the guy on the reviews going, "Where's Tom Bombadil?" There's a very real possibility I'm that guy when it comes to the Dark Tower. So I'm going to try to hold that back. Now, yeah, next week he and I are going to review that. I believe Benjamin J. Cologne was going to be on that show as well. He mentioned he told me he wanted to be, so his schedule permitting and barring the unforeseen, we'll welcome him onto that show. He might be a bigger Dark Tower fan than I am. So don't snort at me. I've only read those books twice. I mean, I love them, and I remember the majority of them, and I read through them again in preparation for the movie, but there's people out there who read them, like, once a year. I don't know how they do that to themselves, but they're not me. So, look forward to Benjamin being on next week when we review The Dark Tower. And I believe that's a wrap. The week after, we will do our Summer in Review, which will encompass, the summer months. So Mark and I will talk about that. Because, the rest of August sucks. We'll be doing that as opposed to review something like The Glass Castle or Annabelle Creation. The week after that is The Hitman's Bodyguard and Logan Lucky. They both look terrible. At least for me. That wraps up with Leap. Yeah, there's nothing for the rest of August. We will be back the first week of September. So this comes out the 8th. So the second Tuesday in September, we will be reviewing It. I will be laughing at Mark as Mark's a big scaredy cat. We all know this and joke about it. I think that's the only thing we're reviewing in September is just It, because then you have American Assassin, which we're not reviewing. We're not reviewing the Kingsman sequel or the Lego movie. We're not reviewing, and the end of that. Yeah, no, that'll be it. Then October, we review the Blade Runner sequel. And he put it back on the list, so we'll be reviewing Geostorm, God help us all, and then Jigsaw. But yeah, so August, September, and October are lean months for us. But we'll close up in November with Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. I mean Thor Ragnarok. Seriously, they're just making another Guardians movie. I'm deeply annoyed. The Justice League movie, Coco. In December, we're reviewing The Last Jedi. And I think that's it. Yeah, The Last Jedi and then Jumanji, because Mark and God hate me. Ugh, so annoyed. Anyway, we had that discussion. All right, so you can look forward to all of that. If you want to follow my other work, this last Sunday, I host the 411 Ground and Pound radio show every Sunday, basically at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. This last episode, myself, Jeff Harris, and Pat Mullen reviewed UFC 214 and the triumphant return of one John Jones. We reminded everyone that, yeah, he's still the best to ever do it as far as MMA goes. Also, Tyron Woodley and Damian Maya put on what I believe to be the worst title fight in major MMA promotional history. It was that bad, guys. I don't say things like that lightly. I'm well aware that there's been some really bad title fights. I think that was the worst. So you can listen to us review that whole card. This coming Saturday in the MMA Zone of 411mania.com, I will be having live coverage for UFC Fight Night 114. It's a card. That's all I can say. With any sort of definitivity. There's some potential for that to be a fun card. So I'm hoping it goes that way. This Sunday, we will be reviewing UFC Fight Night 114. And that's it. The next UFC event is Fight Night 115, which is September 6th. Now, are they taking the whole month of August off? I got to double check this. Hang on. That is the only event in the entire month of August. Well, my paycheck's going to suck. Sorry, it's a joke, guys. It's a joke. Come on. Yeah, so we'll be off for most of August. Jeez. Then we'll be back the last week of August to preview Fight Night 115, which comes to everyone September 2nd. Fight Night against Struve versus Volkov. Then there will be... Oh, I know why they're not doing anything in August. They're not going to... They're just going to let Mayweather-McGregor happen. Joy. Ugh. That fight aggravates me deeply. All right. Anyway, so that's what you can look forward to from me. I'm out. For Mark, who's not here, but hopefully we'll next week, and I hope he feels better very soon. I'm Robert Winfrey. Thank you all for listening. Until next time, please continue to be well, be safe, and behave.